Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with May Tsang. Now, May is a top IP authority, managing partner, and lawyer, and she just has an amazing reputation. Now, May, you have such a great history of success and so many outstanding contributions. Thank you for coming in today and just sharing some of your wisdom and insights with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen, and thank you so much for that warm introduction. I feel very humbled, and I'm looking forward to this. Let's have some fun.
Absolutely. Now, May, an incredible sort of journey you've had from your early life to your professional career, and I just think it's so amazing if you could share some of those experiences, and I know it'll inspire those in the audience as well, and including some of your major milestones.
Sure. I think that my journey has been quite interesting in that it took a lot of winding paths. It went through a lot of places, including cross countries, different cities around the world. And I never thought where I would end up where I am today. So I'm very grateful. To give you a brief history, and I hopefully make this a little brief, but it is a little complicated. So I was born in the city of Xi'an in China. That's where the ancient capital of China is. And that's where they have the terracotta soldiers. You know, one of my old emperor decided that when he passed away, he needed all these soldiers to live with him. So it's quite an amazing place. So I was born there to my mother, who's from Xi'an, and then my father, who's from Indonesia. So because of that, and this is back in the 70s, we were able to actually leave China when very few people were able to. So at age 4, we immigrated to Hong Kong. And it was quite the journey because Hong Kong was so vastly different than what it was China back then. Hong Kong was metropolitan. Hong Kong was rich. China was not. And so when we moved to Hong Kong, it was quite the shocking experience, both in terms of the culture and the language. You know, Hong Kong spoke at that time only Cantonese. And there was actually quite a bit of discrimination against people from mainland China back then. And I recall that my parents were refused service when we would walk into a store because we only spoke Mandarin. Also very differently in Hong Kong back then, it's a very business center world. And China was not at that time. Both of my parents were academic based. My mom is a Chinese medical doctor and my father was an oil engineer. And really, they had a challenging time adapting to the Hong Kong environment. But nonetheless, you know, my mother at that time would work 3 jobs to put me through the best school because she always realized that education is the most important thing. So I grew up a few more years in Hong Kong and really learned the ways of, you know, dealing with different folks than what I saw in mainland China. Then at age about 9, she moved to America, my mother, and then she put me back to Xi'an, which is interesting. Nobody ever really goes back to a third world country, but I did. And I stayed there for 3 years, and those were actually some of the best memories I ever had as a child. That was the China before really all the open door policy. That was the China when there were just bicycles filled with the streets and we took a basket with us down the road to pick up our produce for the day. People were really happy, even though they have very little. You know, we wore the same shoes, same clothes, sometimes for even weeks. and that gave me some really solid foundation of, I think, where I am today. Is to realize, you know, no matter how much money you have or what the outside appearances are, it comes down to really being truly of who you are as a person. So then came another change. At age 13, we moved to America. And, when I was younger, I always thought America really just meant California because all the Ken cigarette commercials, or, you know, ads, they show people in yachts and with sunshine. So when I move here again in 1988, November 8th, landed in O'Hare where there was snow on the ground, I was a little bit perplexed. and then we went to a small town in Indiana. That's where, you know, I sort of grew up from eighth grade on. And that really was another cultural shock to come to a country where I spoke very little English and to be really plugged into the Midwest where there was only two other minority families in town. One of them was a Vietnamese family and the other one was African American. So, but that experience really allowed me once again to kind of figure out, you know, how to survive, how to fit in, and how to move on. I thought to myself at that time, I said, you know, I could really just be depressed because I miss my friends, I miss my culture, I miss the food, or I could try to do everything I can to learn new things, to learn about this culture. So, and I did, you know, and I love the Midwest. I love my hometown in Indiana. I still have a lot of wonderful friends there. Then I went to school at Purdue University with a biology degree. You know, and as many folks are in their 20s, although these days the 20-year-olds are much smarter, I think, than at least what I went through. They have a much better sense of who they are and what they want to do. But for me, I really didn't know. I thought I wanted to be a doctor. But in my heart, I always wanted to be a lawyer. But then again, I didn't think that was a possibility because of the language barrier. So I didn't even think of that as a career choice when I went to college. So after graduating with a biology degree, I did some technical sales, chemical and medical sales, which also later on I realized gave me such a great foundation of what I'm doing today is to have those experience and techniques learned about interacting with people and really honing in on the art of sales, which to some people can sound like a dirty word, but, you know, in reality, it's everywhere. So with that, I you know, was curious about law school, and I looked at the LSAT exam and then realized, oh, I think I can do this. You know, there were logic problems, which I love. So I took the leap of faith and then went to law school. I went to law school at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, a really fine legal institution. And also because I had a science degree in biology, I was able to really explore this area called intellectual property law, specifically with patents. So after law school, I started my journey at big law firms. The one that I started was called Sun and Shine Nath Rosenthal. They were headquartered in Chicago and what at that time called the Sears Tower on the 80th floor. And, you know, as an immigrant, as someone who didn't speak much English, I really thought, wow, I made it. You know, I was so happy, to be in that position. However, you know, the next few years, I learned a lot and, you know, and the journey wasn't easy. It's not easy to be in big law. There's a lot of things you have to learn. There's a lot of insecurities of being a younger associate, I think, in that big environment. So, you know, I really try to figure out what's my next journey, what's my next step. And, you know, I wasn't sure at that time if I was passionate about what I was doing. And that concerned me because I invested a lot in time and money into an education that I wanted to make sure, you know, I go into a profession that I actually really, really enjoy and love. Then, as many times it happens in my life, things just happen. So I met my now husband just randomly in L.A., and we fell in love. And the decision came whether I would have to move to Chicago, he would have to move to Chicago, or if I'm moving to Los Angeles. So, and I thought, finally, here's my chance to be in that sunny California, to see, you know, the boats and the sunshine. So I took a leap of faith and actually took the California bar in addition to my patent bar and my Illinois bar, and moved out here. Having been out in California has just really been a life-changing experience. What I'm so grateful is that I landed in Orange County after a year in L.A. and met Bob Fish, I think one of the best patent attorneys I have ever met, and perhaps in the world. He just has a really different philosophy when it comes to figuring out what IP there is for folks and how to go around protecting it. And most importantly, he has one of the biggest hearts of anyone I ever met. So I'm very grateful to have studied under him. And then in 2007, we were at another big firm, and he said, you know, I want to come out and start my own firm again. Would you like to come with me? And at that time, I was 7 months pregnant, and the thought of going out, and really it was a startup, was a little bit terrifying. But at the same time, I knew that I wanted to follow Bob no matter what. So I did. And we started in his dining room table with the six of us. You know, there was a senior patent agent and Bob and I, and then three staff. And, you know, we really didn't know where we were heading, but we knew that we wanted to be on this journey together. So with that, now 8 years later, we have gone through a lot of trials and tribulations. But we are happy to report that we have, you know, 32 employees, 20 attorneys, both in Orange County, California, and also in Silicon Valley. So, and Bob asked me to become his partner about 3.5 years ago. And then last year, we officially changed the name from Fish & Associates to Fish & Tseng. And so here I am today, as the managing partner of this amazing place, and we have some of the most dynamic, smart, wonderful, kind-hearted, creative people I have ever met. So, you know, I have to say our tagline for the firm is making dreams come true. And for me, my dream has come true. I never really thought this was possible. I didn't even really dare to dream it because it just seemed so crazy as an immigrant, a Chinese woman coming here to be able to be a named partner at this amazing firm. And Stephen, I guess, you know, it's really a time for reflection because I'm turning 40 on Monday. And again, it's been a wild ride, and I'm just grateful for all the people that's in my life along my journey so far that has helped me, because I could not have done this alone. So that was a little introduction. I hope that's okay.
Well, I was just going to say happy early birthday.
Thank you.
I'm just amazed at that story. It's such a fascinating story of accomplishment and perseverance and diligence and hard work and passion. And I know that your law firm now is considered probably one of the best in the world in IP. And it's interesting how, you know, you went on this journey, took a leap of faith in some respects, but maybe having confidence in that ultimately with your talent and the talent of your first partner, that ultimately things would work out. And it has. You know, your reputation is just you know, sort of at the very top, and it's recognized as such, and you're just continuing to expand. And so I guess this leads to this whole idea of IP. You know, you got into this IP area and patents and so forth. And I should mention that, you know, our audience consists of a lot of technologists who are always working on the latest technologies, or dreaming about the latest technologies, and or are trying to innovate. There's a lot of executives in the audience, and they're innovating within their companies or within their organizations. It's required to survive today. You have to continue to have this tendency or orientation towards looking at new things and integrating into your company or organization to stay competitive. And in fact, There's this thing called the Innovators DNA platform, and they even give these five qualities that make for disruptive innovation. So, you know, taking all of that into consideration and the nature of the audience that's hearing this podcast and this interview, what should we know about IP?
That's a great question, Stephen. I think the first thing that everybody should know about IP is that it really exists everywhere. I think that's what sets us apart from other creatures that roam this earth. You know, from the moment you wake up, everything you touch, from your toothbrush, you know, from your hairbrush and from the phone you go ahead and reach, then the car you drive, that's all intellectual property. That's all something somebody have thought of and then had the guts and courage to materialize that idea into a reality. So sometimes I think a lot of folks think, you know, that's just some nerds and geeks. They only think about IP, and it has to be a specialized group of people to have that capability. But really, I think every human being, anything that really comes out of their mind is really what's considered intellectual property. You know, they're basically different vehicles to protect the intellectual property. But they alone do not make what I think is considered IP. I think IP, intellectual property, is much broader. And let me give you some specific things that I think in the legal world that serves to protect IP. So number one, you have patents. And patents are sort of very essential to many, many companies. They protect really the utility of how some things work. So, and that's what many, many companies are doing. They're figuring out how some stuff can work. Now, many people ask me, you know, how do we know we have something that's worth protecting? That's usually a really challenging question. I have a very simple answer to that, especially from a patent perspective. Is that if you ever encounter a problem that you have to solve in your company and or on your own journey, we have a lot of inventors on their own, that you can't find an easy solution, you can't find something on the internet that you could just say, oh, I could just purchase this, or I could just, you know, find this way to do. If you have to figure out a way to do it, then there is most likely some patentability subject matter within what you're doing. It's just that simple. So if you're there to solve a problem and nobody has solved that problem before, it's most likely you have something that can be protected via a patent. So that's really one vehicle to protect it. And beyond that, you have trademark, which is very, very essential in today's world. You know, we have so many apps, right? I remember the first time I, you know, bought, went into the app store, and it was exciting because there was only like, you know, 100 apps and you could almost download it all. But now there are just so many apps. And how do we distinguish those apps? Many of them may not be protected by patents, but they all each have to have a logo. They all each have to have a name attached to that logo. And that's really branding. That's differentiating yourself so the consumer can recognize very quickly by that little white bird that that's a Twitter account versus an F versus a Facebook account, or a little ghost that with a yellow background that's a Snapchat account. So branding has become very essential, especially in today's world. And we could talk a little bit later about, you know, how to really figure out what is a good trademark? What's a good brand? But again, you know, when you think about companies such as Apple, they really done a tremendous job because they have had developed the patents to protect sort of the technology behind their product. But they have done a tremendous job with their branding. You know, they're very, very big on enforcing their trademarks, their brands. And with those two marriage coming together, they have, you know, a huge success with their products. Then there is also copyright. Now, many people think copyright is there to just protect movies, songs, or sort of artistic endeavors. However, in the area, especially, you know, within this forum, Stephen, I think a lot of people should know that software actually can protect can be protected with copyright as well. And it can be a very powerful tool because oftentimes it might not be protected by patents, but at least there's some protection we can get with copyrights. And copyrights actually carries a much greater penalty, so to speak, when there's infringement to be found. And it's one of the easiest right to get among all these rights. So people really shouldn't ignore that. In addition, beyond patents, trademark, copyrights, there's also trade secret. And oftentimes people forget about that, especially perhaps with a lot of startups. You know, they just don't have the bandwidth to think about this. But what I really like about trade secret is that, you know, for a patent to work, it has to be something new. It has to be inventive. For a trademark, it also cannot really infringe on other people's rights, and there has to be some sort of eligibility to pass. It cannot be too descriptive. It has to be sort of whimsical, suggestive in order to get some protection. And copyright, you know, sometimes you want to protect something, but it's just functional and you can't get copyright protection. What's beautiful about trade secret is we really can protect a lot of things, including financial data, client information, your specific policies and procedures on how things are done that's unique to your company, and of course, anything that's created in the process of creating some IP rights. The key thing to remember, though, about trade secrets is that you can't claim something as a trade secret really later on when somebody else has taken that. You sort of have to beforehand to declare that, hey, this is what we consider in our company as trade secrets. And then you have to take some steps to demonstrate that you have been actively and consistently protecting those things as trade secrets. So, and that can be easily done, but many folks don't often realize that. And then when they have a key employee that leaves and perhaps takes some of their technology or their client list, then they try to go back and try to figure out what it is they can do from that perspective, and then it's very, very challenging. So I think those are the things that anybody should really think about. You know, look at their business and see what is it there that they can protect. Now, you know, people sometimes thought, oh, that is so costly. I don't know if I want to spend the money. I always say to those folks that it's true. You know, IP is not cheap. It's not a frivolous item to get, you know, it's not an impulsive item to get. However, they really should look at IP more of an asset rather than a cost. I guess what we do here at Fish & Seng kind of differently than I know perhaps some other firms is that we really serve as almost business consultants for our clients. So when they come in, you know, they're so excited to bring us their inventions and showcase us and want to get a patent on it. But we always kind of go a couple steps back and really try to figure out what it is they want to do with this. I think that's a very important question is to ask why. You know, why do you want to get some protection on this? Why are you even doing this? You know, and people have different motivations. Companies have different motivations. Some companies are there to build, there to stay. And they want to build portfolios to protect themselves, to go after competitors. Then you have companies, a lot of startups do this. They need just some basic fencing, but they also might need to build up a portfolio that's attractive to investors, that's attractive for an exit strategy. So that might be a little bit different than just saying, you know, protecting your product from competitors. And then, so those things are very important to figure out from the beginning. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, we're coaches for them. And we ask our clients a lot of hard questions, and they have to do some soul searching. Because once they start the filing process, these things do get expensive. And I also want to make sure that when they get what I call an IP asset, whether it's a patent, whether it's a trademark, whether it's a copyright, or having good trade secret policy, that it matches their goals. You know, this particular patent is there to ward off this particular competitor. So once we get this patent, you could go after them. Or this patent here is for, you know, potentially for these investors to look at you. So maybe there's a more of a marketing component to these patents. So I think that's important to know. Don't file blindly. Don't file just because you think you need a patent, you need a trademark. You really, as a consumer of legal services, need to understand why you're doing this. And then one other thing I want to say is that, you know, many people too, and perhaps I'm a little bit defensive of this because, you know, I work with such great IP professionals, is that many people think they can really do this themselves. I would strongly advise against that. And here's really why. You know, this is a complicated area of the law. We have had some, you know, sweeping changes in the legal landscape for patents and trademarks and copyrights in these last few years. And it's really not easy to navigate for even us as the professionals, you know, to keep up with all the changes. And many folks make the mistake of, you know, wanting to do it cheaper, easier. Perhaps they go to, you know, one of those online LegalZoom and get things done. And what they don't understand is oftentimes they might be giving up rights. They might be hurting their own business later on because they might have disclosed too much. They might have not filed sooner. They might have not had the benefit of counsel to advise them about international filings. Almost every single client that comes through the door today is not only looking at the U.S. landscape, but they're looking at, I want to go overseas or I have factories overseas. So it's naive to think that, you know, there's many, many great technology out there to make it easier. But at the end of the day, I equate IP professionals as brain surgeons because, you know, the folks that come and work here, myself included, we not only have to have a science degree, we have to also pass the patent bar, which is no other legal professions have to do, not even tax law, even though that's a very complicated area. So, and then we have to pass, you know, the state bar as well. And then we have to have really years of mentorships and training in order to really get what the nuances of all these legal requirements are. So I really would advise anyone, if they have a dream, if they want to make that come true, invest. This is an investment in a great IP professional, that people you feel like that can really help you understand what's going on, why you're doing the IP, why you're having an IP strategy, how is that going to be implemented. And it's really a long-term relationship. You know, the clients we have here have been with us sometimes from their startup days, you know, till now they have built successful companies, because in almost every stage of the company, there's always new IP, there's always new ideas, and they have to look at that with fresh eyes. So those are some of the things I think people should know about IP, Stephen.
So there's so much there in terms of consideration, but also opportunities that you've mentioned and treating IP as an asset. I think that's a great way to, you know, provide a sort of a context of going forward, and especially for the audience. What do you see as some of the trends in IP law?
I think there are quite a few trends that are coming. Number one is that IP law is very complicated and sort of we're in some interesting water, shall I say. And let me give you a brief context for that. Quite a few years ago, at least in the U.S., we have this what's called the business software patent, business method patent. And the business method patents allowed almost any software to get a patent. And what happened was that, you know, sort of almost any patents were getting through the patent office. Things that are sort of really simple computer functions, you know, such as them displaying different prices for a product that you're interested in, but for other similar products, that would be considered a patent. Or online bingo, that would be considered a patent. And what ended up happening was that there were so many patents granted, and once those were granted, what you see is increased litigation. So everybody was getting sued on very simple things that people say, really, should this have been received a patent? Is this really new? And in line with that, you have the, you know, really the birth of patent trolls or non-practicing entities. And, you know, I have to say many people probably despise them, but really they have a brilliant business method. You know, they're taking these patents that are not being utilized and then trying to extract some licensing fees out of those. You know, we could debate the merits of that type of sort of, you know, the merits of patent trolls, you know, but I'm not here to discuss that. But what the reality is that because of the increase of litigation, the courts and Congress felt like they really needed to do something. So what ended up happening is there have been some key monumental cases that came out these last 2 years from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has never dealt with as many IP cases as it has done in the past 3-4 years in its entire history. So, and one of the most important one, really, especially for the audience here, is the Alice case. And the Alice case pretty much says that, you know, that kill basically a lot of the software patents. So if it's something that's not tied to, something that's tangible, then they don't consider that to be inventive. Now, this caused a lot of in the community. Some people say this is the end of the patent as we know it. We here at our firm look at it differently. We think that what happened was the pendulum has swung too far the other way, and now we're just making sure the pendulum swings back a little bit more normal. But as you know, with a pendulum, you have to kind of swing harder to the opposite direction for it to come back in the middle. So we're going through that phase right now. So the Supreme Court came down with this decision, but as often happens, there's a lot of ambiguity in terms with the specifics when it comes to specific patents. So what we're seeing right now is there are a lot of case laws in the federal district levels to really figure out, well, what is eligible? What is patentable from a software perspective? So the law is complicated. That's definitely a major trend, and, you know, it requires really heavy monitoring. Now, there are a lot of legislations that are coming down, too, that are being floated around. We already had a sweeping change with the American Invents Act, which changed this country's patent law from a first to invent, which was one of the few countries left in the world that still had that system, to a first to file. And in addition, now there are multiple legislations that are pending in Congress trying to really curb the litigation from the patent trolls. Now, these sometimes could have the negative effect as well of, you know, having smaller companies that hold patents to be able to bring litigation against their competitors. So, again, this is all new and uncharted. But beyond that, what we are also seeing in the IP world is that there are actually a lot of filings from a global perspective. It's probably not surprising to say, but the China has overtaken the world in some sense in their filing. They have a different system, slightly. They have a patent system that allows filings for applications that are not examined. They still have a system where you have to examine the application, but they have a system where you could just file and you get a rubber stamp, a patent. And then later on, you either could challenge that and then see about the validity of that application. So what this means is that there has been a tremendous increase, especially for Chinese applicants within China to file the utility model application. That's what they're called. But overall, in the world, there has been a lot more filings because I think everything is going global. So everybody wants to file, you know, internationally, which the vehicle to use is called the Patent Cooperation Treaty. It's called the PCT. So I think anybody in the U.S. that has new IP has to really take that into consideration. And then I guess another trend which ties back to my number one point is that for filings, you really have to be inventive. There has to be really something that differentiates yourself. And I think this works both in the IP and really in the business world. What distinguishes you? And this is not just about patents, too. It's about branding, the marketing aspect of it, the way things look. The GUI, the graphic user interface, is huge right now. A lot of software, you know, might have a hard time to get it through a patent system, but we could look at design patents, which really was basis for the Apple and Samsung case, and we could look at trade dress, which is an offshoot of a trademark protection that protects not just the words, but the way things are packaged and displayed and shown. So I think companies and everybody have to be more creative, have to really figure out what is it that they're offering that makes them a differentiator, and then in order to extract more value out of their IP. So those are some of the trends, the bigger trends I'm seeing.
So let me throw a sort of a challenge question to you, and that is, you know, there, you see all of this activity in the IT space, big data is one example, and big data meaning enormous amounts of data from various sources and the analytics around it. And this concept applies to every field, whether it's the stock market or medicine or business, different aspects of business, you name it, there's just huge amounts of data being generated. The Internet of Things is another example. What if somebody in the audience says, you know what, there's all this stuff about big data, and now I have a new method of analyzing that big data in some way, what I think is proprietary and unique, and I've encapsulated that in a piece of software. How can I protect that? Because what I hear you're saying is that, let's say you have a new kind of mathematical approach or proprietary way of analyzing big data that will give you a competitive edge and nobody else is using that you know of, because of some of the changes on the software side. How do you protect that?
That's a great question. And Steve and I agree totally with you that one of the trends I didn't mention is the technology-wise is it's going to, I was at CES earlier this year. It really is going to wearable tech. It's going to big data, 3D printing, smart cars. Those are some of the things that we're seeing. And underlying all of that, right, is the big data. People are trying to capture us in every single possible way while we're sleeping, while we're up. They want to know, you know, even about our pets, they want to know what they're doing in order to get that and the data to get the analysis. Here's the thing. It doesn't really matter if it's in software, if it's in mechanical, if it's in aerospace. If there is something that you're doing that is different, there is a way to protect that. So that's number one. I don't want people to think that software patents are dead. They're not. We continue daily take in clients that have new concepts in that area, and we continue to get patents even with today's landscape. And there's different ways of going about it. One, people always say, you know, they need to understand if you disclose something in a patent, really you're kind of showing it to the public. You're basically telling the public, this is what I created. And I have a little monopoly over this. Here's how it works. So if you want to use this, you gotta get permission from me. You know, so I have to allow you to use it. That's really what a patent is. So when companies come to us and they have, you know, what I call sort of, they have developed the secret sauce, right, to do certain things, to analyze the data in a certain way. We really sit down with them and figure out, what portions of it should we disclose in a patent and what portions of it, if any, we should keep it as a trade secret. And here's a little bit of my trade secret that I'm about to divulge, is that there are ways to do both. There are ways to sort of keep certain really essence of something as a trade secret, and then still go forward with a patent application that disclosed things that allows there to be a patent. There's also a little secret weapon, what we call a submarine patent. What is that? Most people probably don't realize this, but when you file an application, you could actually request it for non-publication. So you could actually get a patent through the patent office and prosecute it, which just means going through the process of going back and forth with the patent office to say why your application is inventive. Now, usually that process is public. Everything they send you, what we call an office action, is posted on the USPTO, and then everything you send back to them arguing is posted. A submarine patent is, you know, where you request the non-publication, and it allows you to go back and forth with the patent office, but then at the same time, you're not making this public. And then if at some point you feel like, you know what, this is actually too valuable, I don't want to disclose this, I don't think this, or you say, you know what, we really probably won't be able to get a patent on this, but at the same time, we don't want to disclose all the things that's already in this application, then you could just kill it, and nobody will know. So that's really a beauty of that. And this is where, again, you really need to work with, I think, a very sophisticated IP professional to help you charter these waters, right? And then things work differently overseas as well. You know, in each different regions, you might be able to get protection, you might not. In Europe, you really, there's very, very little ways to get any software patent. You know, they have to have what's called a technical effect, right? But we brainstorm with our clients all the time to say, okay, what is it that we can do to protect this? And sometimes you have to look at it from different angles. You literally, you know, what we do is we have sort of a brainstorming room, and you get some pizza, you get a couple of drinks, and you brainstorm. And you sometimes have to reach those points where you go, okay, what else is there? And to figure it out what is really protectable. I say that a lot of our job is actually teach people how to invent and how to create. You know, they come in with a little thing, but we really are interested in not so much that thing, in figuring out what do they want the marketplace to do? What do they want to prevent their competitors do? And that suddenly really opens up the horizon for bigger thinking. And then we go through that process with them. That's why we really have to, you know, have this deep relationship with our clients. We need to know exactly what they're doing. But I would say, going back to your question, if somebody comes in to me today with some big data analytics, that's exactly the process we would go through to try to figure out what is it that we can protect for them.
So, yeah, geez, it's just such an interesting discussion. I can see how this could last an entire day. And we only have an hour left.
I love this stuff. There's so much to talk about, you know, in every facet. Yes. So, yes, we should move on to some other interesting topics as well.
Now, what are then some of the top considerations for patents?
That's a great question. I think the first thing, as I said earlier, is that people should really know why they want to do this, right? Why they want to file something. And beyond that, they really need to know what sets their thing apart. There's two school of thoughts when it comes to a lot of patent petitioners. You know, some say, you just come in, tell me what you have. We'll file an application, and the patent office does a search. They have to examine the patent. So they're going to come back to you and tell you, you know, what are some of the hurdles, what are some of considered prior art, things that's already out there. And then we'll deal with it. You know, I think that's a nonsensical approach. One is that it's expensive to get an application. And two, it takes a long time to even get the examiner to look at your invention, your application. By that time, you probably need to know whether or not you have something that you can move forward to really say that you have some protection. Now, you won't get a patent most likely for a few years. There are accelerated programs today that allows you to get it much faster. But it's really important to figure out from the get-go what's out there. You know, I don't know how many times people come in here and they say, I got something new. I searched the internet. I'm in the industry. I know there's nothing like it. What oftentimes they don't realize is that, especially when it comes to something, you know, where you need to get a patent, it's not just in the U.S. It's not English language that they only look at. You know, if you invented a time machine and you go online, you type time machine and you say, oh, nothing showed up. But did you type in time machine in Chinese? Did you type in time machine in Spanish? Did you type in time machine in German? So our job is really to search. The first thing is we help people figure out, is there something else already out there? We need to search sort of worldwide, you know, and not just English-speaking references. So that's something that people really need to figure that out. And again, you need someone sophisticated to do that for you. There are databases that have been built over years and years to do just that. And also, it's really important, I tell people once they, you know, we always come back something that's very similar, if not directly on point. But we don't just tell clients, you know what, fold up, go home, think of something else. We bring them in, and then we say, okay, you know what, usually you have a reason for doing this. So what can you do better than these things that's already out there? Again, going back to teaching them how to invent and how to think. And I think that's really important. So that's a consideration. Again, develop a strategy, as I spoke earlier. It's really important to figure out what are the short-term and long-term plans. Now, I'm the type of person that I don't plan too far in advance because there are just too many variables. But nonetheless, here is the thing about patents that I want everyone to know. All the patents right now that are in litigation are patents that are probably 5 to 10 years old. And what does that mean? That means that somebody have invented them about 7 to 12 years ago. So, in some sense, you think about it for a company, you really need to invent not for today, not for next year, but you need to invent 5 years down the road. You need to invent stuff that's 7, 8, 10 years down the road. You know, and you say, oh my God, that's hard. How do we know? Well, there are trends, right? As we said, everything is going to wearable tech. Everything is going to big data. Everything is going virtual reality, augmented reality. So you got to have a team of people or have the right mindset to really think further ahead. You know, usually the stuff that you just thought today is already being thought by somebody else. I can come in and look at an invention or a concept pretty quickly and have a gut feeling on whether or not you're going to face some hurdles. You know, so that's definitely one thing to consider. Another thing, as we discussed, is think of your IP portfolio as an asset. Now, I'm sure a lot of audience here, this is where I'm going to show you that I'm a true nerd. I played Magic the Gathering, which is a very popular card set. And patents and trademarks and IP portfolio building is very much like Magic the Gathering, where, you know, that game is you build your own deck. That's the beauty of it. You amass all these different cards, and you build your own deck to say, what is it going to work for me? And who am I going against? You know, am I doing a more defensive play? Am I doing a more offensive play? And depending on that, you build your deck differently. And that's really the same mindset in building an IP portfolio. You know, we have seen companies that come in from an industry. I'll give you one example. One of our longtime clients, he's in the bird control product arena. You know, these are the spikes that's on buildings to prevent birds from flying or perching on them. And this is an industry where you don't think there needs to be a lot of innovation. But this client is so sophisticated and had the foresight and had the inventiveness really early on to come and work with us and say, you know, I have some new ideas. How can we protect this? And what ends up happening is that he didn't just get one patent. We end up getting a huge family of patents and trademarks and other rights for him for the company, for the world, around the world for this company. And what did that translate in reality? It translated that into becoming the number one distributor of these products, because in addition to amassing these assets, they also enforce it. And that's really important. You know, I often see people don't have the stomach once they get an IP asset, they get the trademark, they get the patent, and then they know they're infringers, but they say, oh, it's kind of expensive, I don't know, you know, and almost becomes pointless if you're going to be ready to get some assets, but you're not ready to protect them, and you're not ready to carve out your space. So that's another consideration. You know, I say, so it's very, building that deck, building that portfolio is very important. And then also, you know, is to actually do something with it once you build it. You got to play it. You got to go and make those cards work for you, make those patents work for you. And that sometimes takes a lot of courage, and it can be scary. But again, with the right professionals next to you to teach you, to guide you, it can be really key for a company to succeed. Another thing, a couple of things to be aware of is that always be aware who you show your technology to. And this is, I want to emphasize this. I do not mean that if you have something new, don't show it to a single soul until you get protection. Now, ideally, I would love that. I would love that if everybody comes to us the moment they think of something and we go through the brainstorming with them, we search prior art with them, and then we file something for them, and then they go talk to people. Ideally, that would be fantastic. But what I know is that there are a lot of reality there. You know, the reality is that one, it can be costly to do so, not often, but sometimes it can be. It, you know, we have a lot of startups here. You know, they're really struggling. They got second mortgages. And sometimes they need to even know, is this going to be a good idea? So you just have to be aware of who you show this to. You have to also be aware of putting anything online, going to any trade shows, because a lot of times once you do anything public, you cannot recover the rights, especially internationally. If you put something on your website to showcase how cool this product is, you're almost toast to be able to get something internationally. And then it's not to say it's impossible later on to get something, but what really I feel sad for some of these people that come to see us later is not only are you not able to get something, the thing you put out there, your website, can be used against you for newer invention later as your own prior art. So that can be really heartbreaking, so be careful on that. And then another thing is be careful of, you know, there's a lot of crowdfunding now, there's a lot of joint ventures. I cannot stress enough how ownership of IP is such a big issue for a lot of folks, right? I'll give you a scenario. You know, you got a software engineer working for a big company. And then in the evening, you know, he has a group of buddies, and then they ended up developing something new and exciting. And then they come to us and say, you know, we want to start a new venture. We want to, you know, get some IP on this. Now, just that scenario alone, the fact that this person works for another company can be very tricky. You know, depending on where you are, depending on the company, a lot of companies pretty much own your brain, you know, especially with what you do. You know, if you are, you know, sort of just, and, you know, selling tickets for amusement park, and then you're creating software, that's a pretty good argument that, you know, they probably don't own your brain. But if you're the chief software engineer for a company and you're developing things on the side that relates to software, you probably have a huge problem, you know. So that's something to really be mindful of, especially when you get, you know, I've seen oftentimes friends come in and then they say, oh, yeah, you know, we all are inventors on this. Well, that's probably not true. Different assets, again, different IP assets, patents, trademarks, copyrights, the ownership, authorship, and applicant can vary and can really be important. You know, I have folks who file trademark applications under their own name. So my question is, are you actually selling the software under your own name? Are you going out there and saying, Mei Sang, Stephen, you're selling this particular software on your own? And most of the time it's a no. And also they don't realize is that while they might want to put something in their own name, from a trademark perspective, for example, they're also exposing themselves to a lot of liability. So now if something goes wrong, you're getting sued as an individual. Now this means your house, your cars, your spouse's house and cars can be now attached to any judgment. So you have to be very, very careful with ownership. It seems like such an easy question, but every time I drill down, people always say, well, yeah, we haven't formed a company and I'm working with somebody else. She's working with another company. Then we need to really drill down on who can own this and how to own it. So I would say those are some of the things to definitely consider from an IP perspective.
You know, it strikes me that you describe some really great sort of caveats for people considering protection in some way and how to strategize about that. But you also talked about cost and time and overall trends. So I want to drill maybe a little bit deeper, sort of very quickly into that. You know, what is the cost range for protecting in some way? You did mention, let's say, 2 years for patents, but there's kind of a quick process, but maybe some kind of a time range in terms of the different ways that you can protect things and from the inception of the idea and getting in contact with your group to the time that you feel you're protected. And then this third question is sort of related, but it's a broader question, and that is, it occurs to me because you have so many people filing IP with you or wanting to get some protection, you do have a sense of a lot of the overall trends. So you already talked about big data and analytics and wearables and so on. Do you have any sort of broader stroke comments about global trends that you beyond the ones that we already discussed?
Sure. Let me first tackle the cost and time. Cost is always a consideration, and especially, again, for startups, that can be really challenging. And let me break it down into the different categories so your audience can kind of digest this. And then I'm also going to tell you about one of the programs we're coming out to especially help with some of the startups. So cost, usually for a patent application, and this really varies geographically, and I think a lot of that is sort of industry-driven, you know. So your Silicon Valley price is a little bit different than your Texas price. Your East Coast price is also a little bit different, you know, than your Midwest price. But generally, I think that for a patent application, for someone to look at it and brainstorm with you to do some search and then to write an application, not to get a patent, to just put something on file, it's usually somewhere between $8,000 to $15,000. Now, it depends on the geographic areas that can go up. You know, I heard that in Silicon Valley these days, it's, you know, more like $15,000 to $30,000. And it's also because most of those are in the software industry, and that can get really complicated, as we already talked about some of the challenges those specific patent faces, those specific areas. Now, that's really to just get something on file. However, I do want to tell people about a vehicle, which is called a provisional application. And we almost always recommend this for most companies that are starting new or they have really new concepts that haven't been fleshed out. This is where U.S. is the only country that does this, that allows you to file an application. And basically, it's a bare-bone, much more less formal application than what the utility application is. And it does not get examined by the patent office. It's a placeholder. You have a year from the day of filing that provisional. Let's say today is August 5th, 2015. You have a year from till August 5th, 2016 to file this application, to turn this application into a full-blown utility application. This is a great way to protect yourself. And once you file this, you could say patent pending. So that's really important for a lot of companies. The cost of that also varies, you know, and I caution people. I have seen really, really low prices on that, such as $1,000. Now, you have to be careful because the laws have changed. It used to be you literally could sort of file anything and call that a provisional. You could file sketches. You could file drawings on napkins, you know, and then you slap some other portions together and you say, I got a provisional. But those days are gone. It's much more rigorous. So while the provisional does not get examined, this is how it can play out. You get the utility patent, and then you want to challenge someone who infringes on you, and they will look back and see whether or not you have a proper patent, right? And they will go as back as the provisional. If the provisional does not provide enough adequate support to support what it ends up being your utility, that can really kill your patent, okay? So I do not recommend these days people doing it on their own again or doing something really cheap. It really concerns me when I hear $1,000 provisional patent. It should at least be $35,000, $5,000, you know. And I think any company, if you really think you have something, you have to at least invest in that much from the get-go in order to protect yourself. Time. Time is really important. You know, I always tell folks that, you know, even though from the time you file to get examined, it's a few years, you really should ought to think about coming in to see us once you're ready to really do some serious pitching. You know, come to see us before that big pitch. It takes us, and I think most firms, a few weeks to come back, sometimes sooner, to see if there's anything else like it, so you could avoid some landmines. Okay, so that's kind of the time frame to think about. Once you file, not the provisional, but the utility, it usually takes about almost 2 or 2.5 years to get the patent office to first even look at it. And once that starts, you probably have another year before you really get an answer on whether or not you get something allowed. So this process takes a few years, right? Now, there are ways now in the patent office to speed that up by paying. There are a few different ways. If you fall within some special categories, for example, if this is a national security invention, you could move up the line. If you pay an extra fee, you could move up the line. And then there are other ways to move up the line as well. And by that, I mean you have about a year. It's much quicker. But sometimes there are benefits of getting a patent sooner, and sometimes you might want to wait. So it just depends on the circumstance. But that's generally the situation in terms of for patents. Now, internationally, just think of doubling everything in time and in price. International patents can be very pricey. There's a lot more maintenance fees that you have to pay. There's a lot of fees. For example, Europe, you're looking at probably at least $30,000 to $50,000 to get something even on file, and depending on, you know, some of the things and how long you want to keep it going. So it can get really costly. But again, you have to look at an investment. You know, I want people to show me good reasons they want to go to these international countries. Because I think there's over at least 150 countries. If you check all those boxes when you're filing internationally, it's millions and millions and millions of dollars over the life of that patent. So there must be some really good reason for you to actually want to go to those places. You know, and I really caution people to just want to get it because, oh, I want to go in there. Well, let's look at that market. You know, let's look at whether or not their patent law is mature and it's worth actually protecting. That's for patents. When it comes to trademarks, the cost is much lower. But what people need to really realize is they need to make sure that they do at least some searching for trademark. It's similar to patents, that they have something that they can actually feel comfortable will get through. The time frame for examining trademarks, it's the same procedure. The trademark examining attorneys look at it and see if there's anything similar. If there is, they're going to reject it. And it's actually much harder to get through those rejections because if you have something exactly the same and in the same type of goods and services, you're kind of toast. So keep that in mind. The cost, you know, really goes down dramatically. Usually a trademark application, you know, you could do it for $2,000 from the search to filing and then to getting that trademark. And then the time frame for it usually is about a year, year and a half. And also the same thing with trademark is that you could file that internationally as well. They're a little bit pricier, but not as expensive as patents. There's also copyrights, which is probably one of the cheapest things to file. And it's something, you know, you can even do on your own. But again, there are some guidelines. If you go to, you know, the copyright office, which is online, there's easy ways to file. And sometimes we do tell our clients that that's of all the things that might be something you want to train people internally if you have a lot of copyrights you need to file. Now, trade secret, we already talked about that. Usually the cost with that is some agreement work that's a few thousand dollars, and then it's making sure the company has internal structures to have a refresher every so often so their employees remembering that. So those are sort of the cost and time consideration. And Stephen, you asked about the overall trend. I think beyond what we discussed already, which is, you know, to file internationally, is that there's a lot more licensing going on, I think, more and more these days, you know, and really litigation is really, I think in a lot of incidents, it's just a sort of a starting point to figuring out what a licensing deal should be. Companies with a lot of patent portfolios, you know, they used to bundle them more, and now, you know, you're looking at the trends as to unbundling some of that, you know, and then maybe going cross industries. You know, people want to extract more value out of their portfolio, so they're looking at different ways that their IP can apply differently, you know, and in different industries, right? And I think another major trend in terms when it comes to IP is the really use of different IP assets. I touched upon this a little bit earlier, but I want to come back to it. Design patents can be huge. Now, there are some drawbacks because it's really easy to get around a design patent. What a design patent is, it protects the ornamental features of a functional article. Now, the easiest example I'll give you is sort of think about bottles for drinking water, right? There's nothing new from a utility aspect. It's a bottle. It holds, has a housing and has, you know, an opening, and it houses liquids. However, the shape of the bottle, you know, can very much vary. You know, you have the Fuji water, which is a square bottle. Everybody instinctively knows when they see that square bottle, they know, oh, that's a different brand, that's unique, that's an ornamental feature. So design patents are much cheaper to get. Usually they're, you know, in the $2,000 to $3,000 range, depending on how complex the article is. And you get it much faster. And then you can enforce it. You know, you cannot enforce any rights until you get that right. So while you have patent pending, it's really challenging to get any enforcement until you actually have a patent. The same thing with trademarks, same thing with copyright. So the benefit of design patent is cheaper, it's faster to get. But it's narrower in scope. You know, so somebody else may change their bottle just slightly. You might have a harder time. Another one that I really love is trade dress. I touch upon this later. For those of you who ever, you know, had the privilege of receiving or the privilege of giving a little jewelry box from Tiffany Jeweler, you recognize that baby blue. I think everybody recognized that, and you know immediately, oh, that's something from Tiffany. That's really because they have gotten a trade dress on that blue. Harley Davidson has a trade dress on their sound that their bikes make that's unique to them. You don't hear that on any other bikes. So trade dress, and how does this apply in the computing world? It does in quite a bit. You know, your GUI can, you know, if it's unique enough, if there's something there, can be subject to both a design patent and a trade dress. And that can give you a lot of legs. What I also love about trademarks and trade dress is that patents have a shelf life. In the U.S., it's 20 years for utility patents, 16 years for design patents. the trade dress can last forever. Think of the Coca-Cola bottle. They have a trade dress on that bottle shape, and it will be there forever. So I think people are using more creative IP rights to protect themselves. And this is just in the U.S. But in other countries, 3D trademarks are very popular, and they kind of is a marriage between design patents and trade dress. You know, so this, you could get that in China, for example. You could get that in Mexico. And it's a great way to protect yourself. So I think overall, you know, you have to be more creative. You have to really talk to people that know about this in order to figure out how to protect yourself.
Well, there's a lot of considerations here. You know, I'm just conscious of time. And so maybe, you know, we talked about trademarks. You've described trademarks in some detail. Do you have any additional tips on trademarks?
Yes, I actually have some, I think, really important tips on trademarks. And this is my number one tip to anybody out there that wants to file a trademark or has a new company product that they want to slap a trademark on. Number one rule, do not get emotionally attached to any trademark. I've seen this over and over again. I have folks that come in and you know, it's a family name. It's something they've thought of, you know, because of their children. And they get stuck on a name. And it's like buying property. You know, you hear that. You don't get emotionally attached to a house. And why do I say that? Is that what you may consider a good name, there could be some challenges to get that really protected. And to be a successful mark, those are two different things. Number one is that for the trademark office, they only really want to protect marks that are really unique. Because what does a trademark do? A trademark signals to the consumers that when you see the word McDonald's, you know exactly what you're getting. You know the type of burger, you know the fries, you know what it's going to come in the packaging, you know what kind of handling it has gone through. It's for the consumers, actually. It's for the consumers to recognize your brand, to know that there's a certain quality associated, a certain goodwill associated with that trademark. So that's why they want you to pick really unique trademarks. And a lot of people like to pick descriptive trademarks. They like to say, excuse me, you know, made sporting goods. I want to tell people I'm selling sporting goods. I want to tell them that. But that's not really going to have a uniqueness. And so many people are calling that the same thing. You're going to have a really hard time getting that mark. Another thing to consider is other people might be using very similar marks. You know, there's so many trademark filings have increased dramatically because the challenges that are facing a lot of patents, people have to use branding to further differentiate themselves. So, because there's so many marks out there, you really should do a search and do a professional search. Again, not a search you do on the internet. It doesn't pick up everything. And then if somebody else is already using it, unless there's some really compelling reason, which you've been using it for a long time, you have already a lot of goodwill associated, I always encourage my clients to think another mark that you're not going to have to face battles throughout your whole entire life cycle of your products. And a lot of times, unfortunately, people get really tied down to the mark. And they, for some reason, they don't want to give that up. And what that ends up happening is they face challenges from being to get it protected, and also challenges from somebody accusing them of infringing. Here's another thing too. You really should do the trademark homework early. And this is why because most of the time, companies are going to spend resources on printing, on marketing, right? They're going to splash this on social media. They're going to have packaging. They're going to have everything with their mark on it. And then later on, they find out, oh, somebody else is already using it. Now, it's tremendously expensive, and it can have a lot of negative effect. It's hard to rebrand, you know? So you really, again, should do this homework up front to figure out what your identity is. Okay. So those are sort of the big general considerations. Some additional consideration is that register your mark. Okay. A lot of people, there is common law rights in the U.S. for trademark protection, which means you don't have to federally or register statewide, but nonetheless, you should go get that protection because it gives you so much more benefits. You know, it gives you sometimes presumption of ownership after a certain amount of use. It gives you rights to enforce in federal courts, which usually is a better forum, especially against people from another state. And it allows you to enforce your rights at the border, which you can do without a federal registration. So, and also think about international. I always have some fun stories in China, for example. I'm Chinese. I'll use that. There's some trademarks that are just translated so beautifully. For example, Coca-Cola in Chinese is Coca-Cola, which means a little joy in your mouth, you know, and it also sounds like Coca-Cola. So it's one of the most, I think, beautiful, what I call transliteration of a mark. You're not just translating the sound, but you're also translating the meaning. There are some that perhaps didn't bode so well, like Quaker Oats. It ended up being an old man's cereal, you know, so it's not, doesn't have the same effect. And also too, you want to go, most countries, very few left in the world is a first to use. And in America, it is, which means if you first use the mark, you have some rights versus first to file. Except for a few other countries, almost every other country in the world is the first to file. So here's an example, Viagra. Pfizer translated into a pretty boring name in Chinese, in China. But it wasn't a bad name. It was actually a pretty good name. But the conventional wisdom in China translated to something else, which is Wei Ge, which means strong man, you know, and it sounds like Viagra. So what they ended up doing is trying to get that as their trademark, but they weren't able to because somebody else already filed that. And that's really hard, you know, when you're going to a market, you want to have the best name possible. You want to make sure the name does the work for you. So that's something to think about. Make sure to also put notices on your mark, especially if you haven't gotten a registration. Put TM, you know, if you haven't gotten a registration next to the mark. Put SM for anything that you're offering as a service. And then once you get a registration, put the circle art on there. Another consideration in your marketing materials, make sure you use the mark correctly, right? And what do I mean on that? It should be used as an adjective. You know, if you want to say, Victory Software, right? You want to make sure that you put the Victory in front of the software and don't just say use Victory, you know. So it needs to be sort of as a possessive noun rather than just on its own. Watch how your trademark is used when you have either licensees, vendors. You want to make sure you have quality control over the trademark. That's actually one of the most key important things. If you don't police how they're using it, the mark can lose its value. So be aware of that. And also, you know, with social media, that might be hard to do, but you need to have someone monitoring that. And the same thing along with social media and domain names, you know, if that's why you want to do that homework early, it's, of course, the best practice is just to secure those domain names that kind of aligns with what your mark. And especially if there are names that are similar for similar things, even if you have the senior rights, if you can't get the domain name, that often can be a real issue. Enforce your rights. Again, once you get them, people might not have the stomach. I don't know how many times people have acquiesced on the rights they have, and then later on, there's just more people that are using their mark, and then it gets much harder to enforce. So you kind of have to do it from the get-go. You have to, you know, really put your stake on the ground. So basically, those are some of the considerations that, you know, when you think about trademarks.
Now, May, you've described some of the you've gone into quite a bit of detail about the different aspects of protection, and you've also touched on, you know, some of the things that you can do when there's infringement. So can you expand on that? Like, what are your additional tips on infringement?
Okay, here's the thing on infringement, especially in the U.S., where pretty much anyone can sue anyone. It's really something you cannot really avoid if it's going to come your way. And I say, you know, as many things in life, you cannot live in fear, right? You can be smart, but don't live in fear. And that's really important to remember. And the fact is, usually when people are suing you, or, you know, when there is cease and desist, I always see that as what is that other entity or person's end goal to be? You know, is it they are in this marketplace and don't want you to be in this marketplace? Is it that they have some IP, they want to extract some value in that? And I want to, you know, make sure my clients really understand if you are encroaching on somebody's rights, what are you going to do about it? Is it essential for your business? You know, can we let this go? Or, you know, is it something that you want to maybe, you know, strike up a dialogue? I don't know how many times that has happened. You know, when two opponents come into play, they end up working on something together. You have a lot of the non-practicing entities, a.k.a. TROs, right? Now, their business model is almost never to take you, you know, through a lawsuit. Their business model is to really to license, to say you got to pay a fee. You know, you got to cross this bridge. You got to give us a fee. People get very emotional. This is one thing I would say, you know, going back. You can't live in fear. And when you're getting sued, you cannot be emotional. You know, you can't say, oh, I know I'm right. Being right can be very, very expensive and costly, both in money, in time, and your mental space. You know, a lawsuit is very challenging because it's contentious, it's ugly. They want to dig information from you, from your company. It just not only sucks time and money, even if you have that, but it sucks up your mental space. So I always say, what are some of the ways that we can resolve this without going to a full-blown war? Now, sometimes that's inevitable. Sometimes you have to do it. You have to defend yourself because this is your livelihood, and they have patents that don't hold up, and you have to fight it. You know, you have to you have to have certain battles in order to win the war. But it's just, you have to be smart about it. You know, again, if you do the homework right in the beginning, you should know some of the key players that's in your field that might come after you. You know, you should monitor that. You should monitor your competitors and see what they're doing, right? And that really goes for all those rights. That goes for patents, that goes for trademarks, that goes for sort of just, you know, being in the know of the industry. You want to work with your attorneys, you know, whenever you get, whenever even you go decide you think somebody else is infringing you, we, again, put people through the ringer. I really want to say, you know, not just based on this, let's see if we really could make a good claim. You know, we have to already have like 5 steps laid out ahead of us versus just, you know, from a gut reaction, we think they infringe, let's send a cease and desist. You want, you know, once the lawsuit starts, depending on what district you're in, there's some really, really, you know, comprehensive and quick deadlines that you got to meet. You know, you got to demonstrate why the other side infringe, or you got to demonstrate why you don't infringe. That's not something you can do on your own. You really need a good IP litigator next to you that knows the ins and outs of how to work it. Now, there's one thing that's kind of new on the scene. With the American Invents Act that came out about a year and a half ago, it allows now the Patent Trials and Appeals Board to look at patents and see if they should have been granted the first place, you know. And basically what it ends up being, and these are called, you know, IPRs, inter-party reviews, and sometimes they're called CBMs for business methods. And they really allow and then there's another vehicle called the post-grant review. They allow third parties to come into the patent office and basically say, this patent shouldn't be granted. Now, this has become a really, really powerful and almost frightening tool. And why is that? It's because now we're not just fighting usually in a district court. And you know, if Stephen, you accuse me of infringing your patent, my defense is usually saying, no, I don't, and I think your patents are valid, okay? And we have some fights going on and whatnot, and then this could take years. Usually during this time, most of the cases settle. So you go on your merry way, you know, and then you go, you know, you go find another person. You say, okay, you're infringing. Let me challenge you. The procedure now that's implemented at the PTAB level is that I say, okay, you know, Stephen, I think your patent is bogus, so I'm going to challenge you, but not in the district court. I'm going to challenge you over at the PTAB using what I call the IPR. And basically, you have the administrative judges sitting there looking at this with a fine tooth comb. And the thing is, once that starts, it's really hard to stop. So even you and I, Stephen, we made up. We say, you know, I don't have a beef with you anymore. And you say, may stop that IPR from going forward. I say, okay, I'll try. But if the board feels like, well, we invested a lot of this time and we feel like, you know, you are right. They shouldn't have this patent. It shouldn't have been granted in the first place. We're going to examine it and we're going to kill it. And when they kill that patent, it doesn't just affect, you know, your infringement accusing of me. But now perhaps you had other licensees. You have licenses to a 10 other people, or you have like 20 more people you want to sue. Wow, that really kills the whole thing. So it has become a really powerful tool. And that is also a great tool if you're being sued, because that process has to finish within a year if your patent is allowed to be reexamined. And it can have a detrimental effect. So just know that just because you're sued doesn't mean that it might be a little bit painful. Just be reminded, you will have to spend some money to defend it. But the way to do it is to help, hopefully, minimize your risk by really talking to professionals and figuring out what's the right way to go about it. One other thing I want to say, and this is really about selection of counsel. I've done a lot of litigation. I've done a lot of prosecution. I've done a lot of client, just general management. And I'm a passionate advocate for lawyers in the legal industry. You know, I'm running for the board here in the Orange County Bar Association. And to me, you know, unfortunately, the legal industry sometimes gets such a bad rep, but I think lawyers sometimes are one of the most amazing group of people I know. They're smart, they're helpful, they're responsive, they're trained to solve problems and to care. And here's the thing, oftentimes I've seen that, especially when people get in sticky situations such as infringement, that they have to find attorneys that are really ultra aggressive, you know, that promise results, that are just like, we'll do whatever it takes. That might work in certain instances, but I'll say this. A lot of times, it's the negotiation skills of an attorney that's more important to a client than sort of their hardcore trial advocacy skills, because most cases do not go to trial. And if your case goes to trial, something could be wrong. You know, your attorney should probably really kind of figure it out how to prevent you from going that point, because trial is expensive. Trial is laboring. Trial can really, again, suck up a lot of your mental resources and energy. So you really want to find attorneys that know their craft and that have great negotiation skills. And usually that means they're friendly. They're nice people, and you really feel like they have your best interest in heart. A lot of people ask me, how do I go? You know, it's like picking a doctor. You know, you kind of have to go with your gut. I always say, you know, you have to go with someone. They care about me. Your attorney should really care about you. They really should care about what you're doing. They really should care about the outcome. They're not there to just tote about themselves and all their glory. And then your attorney should give you the confidence that you feel like, okay, I think we're going to get this done. But also, I think this is not fair. Don't expect the attorney to work miracles. Sometimes, you know what? You infringe. You might even know. You might even take in something and say, try to get away with it. So, you know, I think that's really important. Selection of counsel right from the get-go is so important for you to succeed. know their motivation. You know, why do they want to take on this case? Do they want to make more money, or do they really have your best interests at heart? So I think that might be a little bit outside of this, but I think it's really important, especially when it comes to when you're getting sued. You know, whether it's for infringement or anything else, I think those are, you know, I would stay within that framework when I'm selecting a counsel.
May, you know, we've spent quite a bit of time discussing the sort of this whole legal aspect of IP and giving all sorts of tips and just great tips and sort of best practices that you shared with the audience. We're going to switch directions now. And the reason is we've got about 10 minutes left. And I just want to get a better sense of you as a nerd. I think you indicated earlier you're kind of a geek freak or a nerd, or you have other interests and maybe your opinions in other areas. So first of all, from a technology standpoint, I'm kind of surrounded by different kinds of computers. I just got a Surface Pro 3, which I just love. I just got Windows 10. Do you have any opinions on those kinds of things?
Oh, yes, I do. You know, I love Windows in general. I've been using Windows, I mean, since my legal profession, right? And it's really essential to what we do. I think, you know, most legal professionals use Windows, and I'm excited about 10 from all things, you know, from the grapevine. It seems like it's really robust, and I'm excited to have an Xbox One, and they're going to, you know, rolling that out in November, so I'm looking forward to using that. And in terms of, you know, especially with the legal industry, we're behind. we really are. You know, we have desktops, you know, we're slow to adapt to technology. You know, I still remember when I went to law school, we were looking at law books, and now, you know, we're really moving away from that, but we're not as quick as some of the other industries. Nonetheless, I think it's really important, at least, especially for what we do, which is IP professionals, to be really adapting to the technology, especially many of them are what our clients are using. So I love the Surface tablet. You know, in my own firm, I want to roll out really testing to use that as the main computer for our professionals. So they're more mobile, they're more integrated, and I'm looking forward to that. I have, you know, have heard from other professionals, legal professionals that are using that, and they have nothing but wonderful things to say. So I'm really excited about that technology. To me, you know, one of my favorite things to do is find new apps and find new ways to interact with clients. You know, you see the trend in our client base has really shifted. I would say when I first started, and to this day it's still true, most of our clients are, you know, older, male, and, you know, they just went away from sort of the, you know, mailing to now emails. But we're seeing more and more younger startups, younger inventors, and they really want to digest the service differently. You know, maybe not even email. They want a text. They want different forms. You know, I've been downloading a new app that my millennial interns are introducing me called Weave, you know, which is like Tinder for professionals. So, there are just different ways that we have to learn and adapt to interact. And I think, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing Windows 10 and the Surface tablets and what they can do in order to help us, you know, to have that more ways to connect with our clients.
You know, May, I'm just fascinated. You're using Windows 10. You're going to get Surface Pros throughout your office. You've got an Xbox. You're turning 40. It sounds like the HoloLens is going to be in your sort of sweet spot as well, because you're gaming.
Well, funny you say that. We're in the process of expanding to a different floor here in Orange County in Irvine, and we've been talking about putting in some arcade games, you know, and of course the first thing everybody thought is sort of the old school arcade, but what we thought, maybe we need to have like a three-step approach. So you have the classic arcade, and then you have, you know, the Xbox, and then maybe we need, like, you know, a virtual reality game console, you know, to just point to the future. But I think, you know, It's fun. We got to, you know, I love what I do. People are here a long, long time, and we got to make a fun environment. And a lot of that is, you know, looking at new technology. It's just fascinating.
Well, it's interesting. And when I'm in California and I attend a lot of different meetings at different offices because I belong to boards or I belong to nonprofits and so on. And I see a lot of the Kinect being used in a lot of the offices, or an Xbox edition, so that they can communicate with each other using things like Skype. So it's just fascinating how all of that's being integrated into our lives. And if I can get my hands on a HoloLens, I can't wait. This is, you know, this idea of augmented reality, and that is sort of marrying the physical world with this virtual world. And I see the possibilities are endless. You know, we're down to our last few minutes, and this is the questions that IT professionals debate, and maybe it's not an area that maybe not so much dear to your heart, but you know what? You're immersed in technology, and you're immersed, or I should say immersed in technology, and you're immersed with people who live in and eat and breathe technology. So this question is about computing as a profession, and you're in a profession, law. It has rigor in terms of professional development, code of ethics, personal and public accountability, quality assurance, recognized credentials. Do you see any benefit in computing becoming a recognized profession on par with law?
Definitely. I think that, you know, we're in the whole entire, you know, sort of almost, we look back years later, this is such a fascinating age to be in, right? Everything is going to computing. Everything that we do right now, people are trying to figure out how, from a computing perspective, we can make it easier. We can make it so we could derive that data to do more analysis to make us better. I think there's just this age of enlightenment almost when it comes to computing. So with that, there needs to be regulation. There needs to be sort of that up-leveling of that profession besides just sort of the conventional, you know, nerds and geeks. And in fact, as I have said this many times, it touches upon all those professions, right? When you listed accounting, medicine, law, all those things really now need computing. Medicine, you know, we're seeing a surge of, you know, merging of medicine and computer science together, right? Apps that are coming out, technology that are coming out that are sort of, you know, really crossing the different fields. So with that, I think it is important to have those things, to have a code of ethics, to have some personal responsibility. I think what I noticed, you know, having mentor a lot of young professionals, when you're talking about people in these type of space, right, when you're talking about computing people, they're really, really smart. They're really intelligent. And one thing I know about intelligent people is that they want to strive for excellence. They want to strive for more. So if there are codes, they're going to want to achieve those things. They're going to want to make it better. And what could be better than you have a group of people trying to figure out what is it that we can make this profession better? So I think we're sort of in that beginning stage, but it definitely should be on par as a recognized profession.
May, we're down to a very last question, and this is about, can you close with maybe some interesting story, amusing, unexpected? You do a lot of speaking and traveling, and you must encounter some really fascinating experiences. Is there anything you want to share? If not, then reversing this interview, if you had any questions you think I should have asked, then what are they and what would be your answer? So you can cherry pick amongst those two scenarios.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I saw these questions and they're not easy. Now, I've done a lot of traveling, a lot of experience. But what I will say is this. I am at the core of my being is a people person. I just love people. I am probably one of the most optimistic, happy people you'll ever meet too. And recently, I'll share this story, a more recent travel. I went to China with a client and to help them source factories in China. Now, this kind of goes outside of my legal skills because, you know, it's not exactly IP work, but I felt that it was important to go with this client because, you know, they're Caucasian American, and they'd been to China before, but I felt like this is the core competency of, this is the core factory for what they're going to be doing. And I just feel that personal tie to them. So I went, and it was such an interesting day. While, you know, I advise a lot of people, I don't generally go to China to source factories. So this was sort of my first time. And I am humbled by sort of what China has done. You know, we were in Hubei province, which is probably one of the most polluted province in China because it's one of the province that does all the metalwork. And, you know, we were greeted by these factory owners that used to be farmers, right? And it was interesting. We visited like three factories during the same day in the same region, and they would, first factory would drop us off a road, and then the other factory will pick us up, and then they'll drop us off to the side of the road, another factory will pick us up. I mean, in some sense you go, okay, this can be really sketchy, right? They could just kind of kidnap us, and, you know, we have no really other recourse, right? We're being driven around by these factories. But as I fondly remember the China I knew when I was living there, I felt so happy to sort of see the progression and the hard work that these folks are putting in. I mean, these conditions have improved, you know, from the years ago that I was there, but it's still hard. You know, these people are still living a really hard life. I saw factory workers that are really struggling, you know, and there's no safety standards for some of them. Some factory owners are really nice and they're good to their people. And that's one reason is my client want to make sure we find factories that are actually kind and adhere to safety standards. But a lot of these folks are still living in really shabby conditions, you know. And you forget sometimes, you know, you forget when you're living in Orange County, and then there's so much wealth that's in these areas, you know, in Silicon Valley, you forget that the things you touch, the stabler that's on your table, you know, that's really made by somebody that's their livelihood. You know, I looked at some of those ladies and I knew that that's what they're going to be doing for the rest of their life because they're trying to better their kids, you know. It really humbled me once again, you know, and realized not to get ahead of myself and always remember where I came from and where people are. You know, it's easy to say, okay, you know, I have had some experience and this is who I am. Really, you know, we all should remember everything we touch in life. It takes a whole network of people to make it happen. So I think, you know, I'll end with that. And along those lines, you know, I am so appreciative of the people that's in my life that made it all possible. You know, they're really the greatest resources, I think, for me, is really the people. At the end of the day, you know, with the right people on, you know, I say with the right people, you could do anything. And with the wrong people, you can't do anything. So, but I'll leave with that and let me know if you have any other questions.
Well, May, again, thank you. I know you've got to go. It's a hard stop. And we're so fortunate for you to come in and share so much of your experiences and insights with our audience. So thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with May Tsang. And May is a top IP authority, managing partner, and lawyer.